Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is April 27, 1981, and this is my audio letter number 64.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start. Shuttle, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
And that's how it all began, my friends, just 2 weeks ago, Sunday, April 12, 1981. After years of delay, America's first attempt to launch a space shuttle into orbit had finally begun. In days gone by, the voice of Mission Control has always been a familiar hallmark of American manned flights into space. In the early days, beginning with Project Mercury, the voice was that of Colonel John Shorty Powers. Later, during the Apollo program, there were other voices. But regardless of who it was, that familiar voice of Mission Control would always stay with us throughout each space flight. That is, until this time. This time, the voice of Mission Control, up until the moment of launch, was that of NASA spokesman Hugh Harris. The last words Harris spoke as the voice of Mission Control were the words you just heard, "The shuttle has cleared the tower." Television cameras followed the shuttle as it climbed higher and higher on a column of steam and smoke. For another 30 seconds or so, we were allowed to hear the slowly fading roar of the shuttle's rocket engines. Then the sounds for Mission Control abruptly changed. Exactly 45 seconds after liftoff, live audio from Mission Control was terminated. In its place, NASA began feeding the radio and television networks an elaborate tape recording, which had been prepared far ahead of time by NASA. The changeover from live audio to the NASA tape recording sounded like this. Just 45 seconds after liftoff, the falsified NASA coverage of the flight of the Columbia began. We were still able to see the Columbia by way of long-distance television cameras for another minute and a half, but the sounds we were hearing were no longer live. They were the sounds of the special NASA tape recording. For the first minute or so of the tape recording, we heard nothing but the sound effects simulating conversation between the shuttle and NASA Houston. Then for the first time, we heard the anonymous new voice of Mission Control. It was no longer the familiar live voice of Hugh Harris, but the recorded voice of someone else. For added realism, the new voice was interrupted in turn by the recorded voice of the alleged capsule communicator, Daniel Brandenstein. It sounded like this.
1 minute 45 seconds coming up on go, no, go. Columbia, you're negative seats.
That call up says Columbia, the altitude is too high for ejection seat use.
By that point, the shuttle Columbia was more than 20 miles high and climbing fast. Everything was going according to plan so far, so the things we were hearing on the tape recording corresponded to what we were seeing. We could still see the shuttle on our TV sets, but it had dwindled to nothing more than three bright spots dancing in the distant sky. The last thing that you and I were able to see and verify for ourselves about the shuttle was the separation of those two giant solid rocket boosters. A little over 2 minutes after liftoff, we were able to watch the boosters, two burning bright spots, break off to each side. That left only the single tiny flame of the shuttle itself, gradually fading into invisibility. Several seconds later, the NASA tape recording caught up with what we had already seen and said the boosters had separated. Moments later, the tiny bright dot of the shuttle faded from our screens. It was too far away for the television cameras to follow any longer. We had had our last look at the real space shuttle Columbia. In audio letter 62 2 months ago, I gave an advance alert about the secret military mission of the space shuttle Columbia. At that time, I made public what the mission was really all about. I was also able to reveal what to expect in the falsified NASA coverage of the mission. The falsified coverage was designed to accomplish two purposes. First, to completely hide the military nature of the mission. And second, to make sure the mission looked like a total success, no matter what might happen in secret. As I detailed in audio letter 62, the Bolsheviks here in the federal government are depending heavily on the space shuttle program to get ready for a nuclear war against Russia. The falsified NASA coverage of the mission of the space shuttle Columbia was carried out exactly according to plan. I revealed this plan 2 months ago. There were the standard brief cockpit scenes made by techniques which I will describe later. Just to make it look good, it was spiced up by telling us that a few non-critical tiles had fallen off. Otherwise, we were told over and over how perfectly the Columbia was performing. 4 days ago, on April 23, a news conference about the flight was held in Houston, Texas, by the alleged two astronauts, John Young and Robert Crippen. The entity called John Young summed up the flight in words that were more meaningful than most people suspected. Referring to the falsified flight, which we followed on television, he called it, quote, even better than normal, unquote. And so it was, my friends. The Bolsheviks who now control NASA bent over backwards to paint the image of an abnormally perfect shuttle flight. Meanwhile, the actual shuttle mission, which was carried out in secret, did not go according to plan. After the shuttle disappeared from our television screens, the flight continued for barely 4 more minutes before disaster struck. The Columbia never even reached Earth orbit. My friends, I believe you have both the right and the need to know what happened to the space shuttle Columbia 2 weeks ago. I believe you deserve to know in detail how and why the truth was hidden from you. The stakes involve nothing less than the very survival of our land and our way of life. My three special topics for this audio letter are topic number 1, the advanced preparations for the space shuttle mission. Topic number 2, the aborted flight of the space shuttle Columbia. And topic number 3, the NASA cover-up of the Columbia disaster. Topic number 1, there is an old saying that seeing is believing. For that reason, television has become the number 1 tool of deception in America today. Through television, we are made to see things we do not understand so that we will believe things that are not true. If television were used honestly and constructively, television could be a great force for good. Instead, it's used continually to hoax, deceive, and mislead us. Videotaping makes events which took place weeks or months ago look as if they were taking place live right before our eyes. Computer editing enables scenes to be spliced together to create completely artificial images that look real. Special effects of all kinds enable these television hoaxes to be very convincing indeed. 2 years ago, I described one major television hoax in detail in audio letter 44. That hoax involved no less than the NBC television news program Meet the Press. Now we have been treated to another great television hoax, and this one was the granddaddy of them all. In terms of sheer deception, This was the Meet the Press hoax. Guyana and Skylab all rolled into one. This was the hoax coverage of the first flight of the Space Shuttle Columbia. To begin with, we were led to believe that until 2 weeks ago, no space shuttle had ever left the Earth's atmosphere and gone into space. We were also led to believe that the very first space flight by a shuttle had to be an orbital flight instead of something less extreme. To make matters still worse, NASA swore up and down that this very first flight, pushing the shuttle to its limits, just had to have men aboard. At one point, even John Young himself was quoted to this effect very widely in the controlled major media. For example, 2 months ago on February 15, the New York Times carried a big article about the shuttle. Quoting from the article, Mr. Young said to have conducted an unmanned orbital flight of the shuttle first would have added perhaps $500 million to project costs and met another year's delay, unquote. Statements like that were cooked up purely to explain away the many things that did not add up about the announced plans for the Columbia's flight. Many people believed these explanations, but they were just a litany of lies. For example, time after time during the television coverage of the alleged flight this month, John Young's earlier statement was totally contradicted. Authoritative spokesmen pointed out over and over that the astronauts control the shuttle by telling computers aboard the shuttle what they want. The computers then do all the actual activation and control of the shuttle. And in an emergency, the shuttle can fly itself into orbit, re-enter, and even land itself without help from the pilots. So much for all those lies NASA told us about an unmanned first flight being impossible. The real reason astronauts were aboard the first orbital flight was the one I revealed in Audio Letter 62. It was a military mission, and the astronauts had to be aboard to carry it out. NASA told us that the flight this month was only a test flight, with the cargo bay practically empty. But the cargo bay of the Columbia was not empty. It carried a laser-armed spy satellite, equipped with special shields to protect it against Russian space weapons. But wait a minute, you say. They showed us live pictures from space, and you could see that the bay was empty. No, my friends, not live pictures, but videotapes. The pictures with the doors closed were taken inside a training mock-up of the shuttle that is carried inside a specially modified Boeing 747. The pictures with the doors open were taken on the ground, inside a darkened hangar. Then these scenes were combined by videotape editing techniques with videotapes of the Earth taken from orbit years ago. The final product was what you saw on television. It was not what it appeared to be, but seeing is believing. My friends, the next time you see a replay of those scenes with the shuttle doors open, supposedly in space, there is a telltale clue to look for. Look at the shadows visible inside the open cargo bay. Shadows in space tend to be sharp and harsh because there is no air to soften and diffuse them. The shadows we saw in the videotapes on television were softer because they were not made in space. Also, look at the angle of the shadows. The Earth is shown floating straight overhead, and it is all in daylight. Look at the slant of the shadows inside the open cargo bay. Then ask yourself, where is the light coming from to make shadows like that? The impossible shadows which we saw in the shuttle bay videotapes are just one small example of the many discrepancies in the NASA hoax. More to the point, NASA has pretended that the Columbia flight this month was the very first shuttle flight into space. We are supposed to believe that the only previous shuttle operations were a few gliding tests launched from mid-air by another modified 747. Nothing could be more ridiculous or more untrue. There is one very obvious question about the space shuttle program which NASA has always managed to sidestep. Somehow, no one ever quite dares to ask it. The question is, why wasn't the Space Shuttle Enterprise the first to be sent into orbit? After all, the Enterprise made its public debut nearly 4 years ago, in the summer of 1977. To all outward appearances, the Enterprise looks almost identical to its sister ship, the Columbia. The differences between the two are so subtle that you would never notice them unless you knew exactly what to look for. The engines of the Enterprise look just like the engines of the Columbia. The Enterprise is also covered with the same system of thermal tiles as the Columbia. So again, the question is, why wasn't the Enterprise sent into orbit long ago? Why did NASA wait 3 years and more to launch the Columbia instead? The answer, my friends, is that the Enterprise was designed to be a training ship for shuttle astronauts. It is not meant for orbital flight. Instead, it is specially equipped to make shorter suborbital flights into space. In effect, it can do everything short of going into Earth orbit. It can climb to orbital altitudes as high as 125 miles before dropping back to Earth. This enables astronauts to practice working in weightlessness for up to 5.5 minutes at a time. It also allows astronauts to practice landing the shuttle, slowing down from speeds of around 5,000 miles per hour. The Enterprise is exactly like its sister ships in the crew compartment and cockpit. What makes the Enterprise radically different is the cargo bay area. The Enterprise cannot carry cargo, because the bay area is taken up by rocket fuel tanks. The tanks of the Enterprise can hold well over 100,000 pounds of rocket fuel when fully loaded. To make a suborbital hop into space, the Enterprise is perched on top of a modified Boeing 747 known as the launch aircraft. Inside the 747, there are technicians with instruments and support equipment for the shuttle. The shuttle Enterprise is loaded with rocket fuel, and then the 747 takes off. At an altitude of around 40,000 feet, the shuttle is launched. The launch techniques are derived from the old days of the X-15 research airplane and others before it. The Enterprise is released from its mounts, rises up, and then falls back behind the 747. As soon as it is clear of the 747, the Enterprise starts its rocket engines and zooms upward at a steep angle. After a minute or so, the rockets shut off, and the Enterprise is left to coast upward to its peak altitude and then drop back toward Earth. From the moment the engines shut off until the shuttle begins re-entering the atmosphere 5 or 6 minutes later, the astronauts inside are weightless. Astronauts Young and Crippen made more than half a dozen training flights like this aboard the Enterprise before they lifted off aboard the Columbia at Cape Canaveral. That is why they were so ready to go all the way into orbit. They had already done everything else that was necessary to work their way up to it. Of course, other training was necessary to work their way up to those suborbital flights aboard the Enterprise. For one thing, they spent many hours in a detailed replica of the shuttle, which is housed inside a modified Boeing 747. The flying mock-up, as it is called, is a simulator designed to acquaint astronauts with shuttle operation as realistically as possible. One of its advantages is that it can even provide periods of weightlessness of up to about 45 seconds. The 747 pilot does this by flying a precise arc through the air called a parabolic trajectory. It's an old technique developed a quarter century ago to help astronauts get accustomed to weightlessness. All of these things and more were originally conceived and developed for purely technical reasons. But they are being kept secret from you because the Bolsheviks who now control NASA have turned them into tools of deception against you and me. Lately, publicity about the Space Shuttle program has been focused on three geographic locations. One is the launch site for orbital missions, Cape Canaveral, Florida. Another is Edwards Air Force Base, California. The third is that old standby, the NASA Manned Space Flight Center in Houston, Texas. As always, we are being distracted from paying serious attention to the one area that is most important of all. It is the missing link, the true nerve center of the entire space shuttle program. My friends, I'm talking about the White Sands Missile Range in southern New Mexico. Most people today rarely give a second thought to White Sands. Few people remember that White Sands is where America's space program got its start after World War II. Captured German V-2 rockets were taken to White Sands to be studied and test-fired. After the V-2s, there were American rockets, the Navy's Viking series, and others. They were launched, rocketed upward into the fringes of space, and came back to Earth, all within the boundaries of the vast White Sands missile range. One time, a missile got out of control, veered south, and almost destroyed a small Mexican town when it crashed to Earth. But that incident was a dramatic exception to the normal situation. Most of the time, no one outside White Sands even knew when rockets were launched. Recently, the public has been made aware of the vast, wide-open spaces that constitute Edwards Air Force Base in California. For comparison, White Sands is so huge that it would hold nearly 100 Edwards Air Force bases. White Sands, my friends, is the training base for space shuttle pilots, and since late 1977, it has also become much more. It is the geographic key to the secret military missions which are now the central focus of the space shuttle program. The shuttle program today is being managed in a way that is far different from the original plans. In August 1977, we were shown early gliding tests of the training shuttle Enterprise. The plan of NASA was to drum up public support for the shuttle program, just as they had done a decade earlier in the Moon program. In Audio Letter 26, I detailed how the Apollo program, the biggest military program in American history, was disguised as a peaceful scientific venture. In the same way, the original plan was to bathe the military shuttle program in the glare of deceptive publicity. In the process, we would have learned about the suborbital space capability of the Enterprise. Even the crucial White Sands would have received more publicity. What changed it all was the secret battle of the Harvest Moon in space, September 27, 1977. This secret space battle, which I made public that month in Audio Letter 26, took place barely 1 month after the first gliding tests of the Space Shuttle Enterprise. Russia's military takeover of space was underway. Only the next month, October 1977, a newly operational Russian Cosmos interceptor shot down Skylab. Skylab, along with its crew of 5 American astronauts secretly aboard, died in a giant fireball over the United States. I reported on Skylab's fate that month in Audio Letter 27 and also revealed that NASA was initiating a prolonged cover-up of what had happened. NASA wanted everyone to forget about that mysterious headline-making fireball. So they pretended that Skylab was still in orbit, but sinking unexpectedly. NASA used stories about the space shuttle as part of their Skylab cover-up. They pretended that perhaps the shuttle would come along in time to save Skylab. As I reported then, that was a double lie by NASA. First, Skylab could never be saved because it had already been destroyed. Second, the United States was in no position at that time to launch the shuttle or anything else of a military nature into space. Russia was deploying her secret new space triad of advanced manned space weapons. America's previous military control of space had been totally shattered by Russia. Our military base on the moon had been put out of action in the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Russian Cosmos interceptors had started sweeping the skies clear of American spy satellites. And Russian hovering electrogravitic weapons platforms, the Cosmospheres, were making headlines by creating enormous air booms along the East Coast and elsewhere. All of these things took place just as America's space shuttle program was getting off the ground. The result was a complete reorganization of the shuttle program. The old plans to bathe it in continuous publicity were thrown out. The Bolsheviks here, who have replaced the Rockefeller cartel in many areas of power, cast a net of secrecy over all these new military plans. We were never told about many of the capabilities of the training shuttle Enterprise, and we were never told about the many things which are going on at White Sands in the military shuttle program. By keeping these things secret from us, the Bolsheviks here have placed themselves in a powerful position to deceive us. We have never been told about the modified NASA 747, which carries a complete replica of the crew quarters and cargo bay of a shuttle. Therefore, we are unaware that this airplane, originally intended for training, has become a Bolshevik tool of deception against us. When we saw videotapes of astronauts in the simulated shuttle cockpit, we naturally thought it was the real thing. Seeing a notebook float in mid-air for a few seconds next to the astronauts, we were supposed to think they are weightless because they are in orbit. We were given no clue that these moments of weightlessness had taken place months earlier in a 747 flying a controlled arc through the air. Likewise, we were shown one or two episodes of the astronauts moving around the cabin, obviously weightless, for up to 3 or 4 minutes. What we were not told is that these scenes had been videotaped months earlier during suborbital space hops by the training shuttle Enterprise. Many of my listeners have called or written with the same observation about the first of these episodes shown the day of the launch. We heard the alleged live conversation of Young and Crippen, and yet, in the television picture, they were not moving their lips. They had merely posed for the camera during a suborbital flight months earlier, and they recorded the soundtrack we heard only days before the launch. While NASA may have fooled you and me about the space shuttle, they did not fool the new rulers of Russia. They learned last fall what the flight of the Columbia was really all about. And, my friends, when the Columbia was launched 2 weeks ago, the Russians were ready and waiting.